throats. So with a waist reduction of a few inches, you'll probably be able to prevent or reduce these sleep problems by 30% early in your program. A higher risk of joint problems. While strong, your joints are like parents trying to squash constant whining. They can only take so much before they break down. Your knees are some of the most powerful joints in your body because you use them to both push off and absorb force. But they're also prone to wear and tear if they have to carry a heavier load than they're designed to. When you gain 10 pounds of body weight, it feels more like a 30-pound weight to your knees while you're walking. When you walk upstairs, the 10 pounds of fat feels more like 70 pounds to your knee joint. That extra weight makes you more vulnerable to developing joint deteriorating conditions like osteoarthritis, which occurs when your joints get nicks in their smooth cartilage from bearing a load they're not designed to carry. When you reduce your omentum fat and your waist size, you'll automatically reduce your risk in so many areas of your health. Even better, you'll have the potential to see dramatic reductions in risk factors. When overweight people with an average weight of 225 pounds lose about 7.5% of their body weight, which is about 17 pounds or 4 inches of waist size, they improve their HDL and LDL cholesterol levels, blood pressure, and blood sugar numbers by, get this, 20%. That's nearly 3 times the benefit compared with percentage weight loss. Take the following steps to help you get there in terms of both inches and risk factors. U-tips. Know your fats. Fat in foods, like bosses, comes in 2 broad categories. Those that are good for your well-being, and those that want you to suffer. The strongest influence you can have on your levels of cholesterol, not to mention your waist size, is by watching what fats you're eating and what fats you're banishing from your life and your gut. Above all, you want to avoid saturated and trans fats. A serving size should have no more than 4 grams of those 2 villains combined. They're the foods most associated with long-term weight gain and clogging your arteries. Essentially, bad fats are ones that are solid at room temperature. Animal fat, butter, stick margarine, lard. Trans fats contain cross-linked hydrogen bonds, which make it stable for long periods of time at room temperature. Eating trans fat leads to abnormalities in cholesterol, as well as increasing inflammation and damaging your arterial cells, which makes you more prone to clotting. By the way, trans fats were originally designed for candle wax, but the market died with the advent of electricity. The value of trans fats is that they have a long shelf life. The average food manufacturers would love to make foods with healthy fats, if they could have the 1-year shelf life that they can get from unhealthy fats. The good fats, by contrast, are the ones that are liquid at room temperature but get thick when they get cold, like olive oil. They help raise your HDL levels to clear away the gunk. Far more important than the calories of fat are what fatty acids can do to your cell functions and how they influence arterial function and inflammation. The best oil to have in your home is extra virgin olive oil or organic or cold-pressed canola oil. For cooking, you can also use sesame or peanut oil. That's because their smoking point, that is the temperature at which the fat burns, is very high. Cook beyond it and you'll end up with a burned charcoal flavor. Once heated, oils can become rancid and also can generate toxic chemicals. So you lose the major benefit of eating these usually healthy foods. Also, it's best to cook the food rather than the oil. So don't heat the oil directly in the pan. Instead, roll your food in the oil first and then heat the food so the oil doesn't become overheated. Here are some smoke points for commonly used healthy oils. Unrefined canola oil, 225 degrees. Unrefined sunflower oil, 225 degrees also. Extra virgin olive oil, 320 degrees. Virgin olive oil, 420 degrees. Sesame oil, 410 degrees. Grapeseed oil, 420 degrees. And finally, refined peanut oil and semi-refined sesame oil are both 450 degrees. Clear it all up. More and more evidence is showing that clog-free living is correlated with raising your amount of HDL to thwart the clot-triggering process. By raising your HDL, you increase the amount of healthy cholesterol that's available to clear away the lousy cholesterol. Things that have been shown to effectively raise HDL include consuming healthy fats found in olive oil, fish, avocados, and walnuts. Walking or any physical activity for at least 30 minutes a day, no excuses. Taking niacin. Take 100 milligrams 4 times a day. Regular and over-the-counter niacin is much cheaper than prescription niacin, and there seems to be a beneficial effect of extended-release doses. Sometimes higher doses are needed, in which case your doctor needs to peek at your liver function to ensure that you avoid the uncommon toxicity. To reduce flushing, which is feeling hot and lightheaded, take an aspirin half an hour ahead of time and take the niacin as you go to bed. Do not increase the dose above this level without talking to your doctor, and check with your doctor before using niacin at any dose if you have a history of liver problems. Taking vitamin B5, which is pantothenic acid, we recommend a dose of 300 milligrams a day to decrease LDL and raise HDL with no side effects yet known. Having one drink of alcohol every night. You should not be drinking just to get your HDL level up, but if you do drink alcohol, stick to one drink, and you may see some small beneficial effects. Substituting protein or monounsaturated fat in place of carbs. Recent research suggests that this can help reduce blood pressure and modify lipid levels. Just say yes to this drug. If there were one magic pill for fighting fat and saving life, the pharmaceutical industry would send everyone from scale makers to diet book authors to bankruptcy. There's no pill that will do it all, at least not yet. But that doesn't mean you can't use drugs to improve your health and reduce your cardiovascular risk factors. Our recommendation, and the closest thing to a pill with mystical powers, comes in the form of 2 baby aspirins a day. You need 2 rather than 1, since many folks are resistant to the lower dose. There is no measurable increased risk of stomach problems in studies with this small increase in doses from 1 to 2 baby aspirins, and the reduction in heart attacks or ischemic strokes goes from about 13% to about 36%. Aspirin makes platelets less sticky and decreases inflammation that occurs to narrow the space where blood flows through your arteries. And it's been shown to reduce arterial aging and immune system aging, and that means decreasing your risk of everything from heart attacks, strokes, and impotence to colon, rectal, and esophageal cancers, and maybe even breast and prostate cancers. To avoid the gastric side effects, drink a half a glass of warm water before and after taking the pill. See your doctor if you have any history of serious bleeding or are taking blood thinners. Have regular readings, not just with your book club or by an astrologer. These regular readings are about tracking your health numbers. Instead of measuring your success through the scale, the real measurement and test of your success is seeing whether you've reduced your cardiovascular risk, as evidenced in the following test readings. Blood pressure. Optimal level is 115 over 76. Blood pressure readings can be variable, so have your blood pressure taken in the morning, during the day, and at night as part of your normal activities. Take the average of 3 readings to come up with your base numbers. After that, take the readings every month to help you monitor your progress. If high, then you can track it daily. Lipid profile blood test. Have one now to establish your baseline measurement. Then, have your blood analyzed every other year so that you and your doctor can watch changes and make appropriate adjustments to your eating and drug plan. HDL or healthy cholesterol. You're at a low risk if your HDL is greater than 40. But like basketball players, the higher the better. In fact, if your HDL is over 100, the chances of having a heart attack or stroke related to a lack of blood flow are smaller than the chance that a Hollywood celeb could walk through Boise, Idaho unnoticed. Except in some extremely rare cases where HDL malfunctions inside the body. There has never been a heart attack or stroke due to lack of blood flow reported in the entire medical literature in a person with a functional HDL over 100. LDL or lousy cholesterol. You're at a low risk if your LDL is less than 100. By the way, research shows that for all women and for men over 65 years of age, the LDL number isn't nearly as important as the HDL. So women and men over 65 don't need to obsess too much over LDL levels unless their HDL levels are too low. Fasting blood sugar should be below 100, and C-reactive protein should be below 1. Get a lift. Muscle isn't just for football players, bouncers, and souped-up cars. Everyone benefits from adding some muscle to his body. In fact, adding some muscle will help lower your levels of blood sugar. The more muscle you have, the more you increase insulin receptivity. That is, the process by which insulin transports glucose into your cells. If you gain muscle and lose weight, you change the chemistry of your cell membranes so that you absorb more glucose throughout your body rather than having it stay in your blood. Stop freebasing sugar. One thing that causes blood sugar to spike is sugar. That is straight, pure sugar, not eaten with any other substances like fat or protein around it. Though we recommend eating as few simple sugars as possible, if you do eat them, you should always be sure not to eat that candy bar or cookie dough by itself. Have a handful of nuts or some olive oil with bread first, that slows your stomach from emptying and will keep sugar levels from creating a pyrotechnical effect in your blood. Go chrome. Chromium, a mineral found in a variety of foods, especially mushrooms, seems to help control blood sugar. Taking 200 micrograms a day of a supplement chromium picolinate can aid in the uptake of insulin to help your cells use blood sugar for fuel. Though the studies aren't definitive at this point, we recommend the supplement for waistline and blood sugar control. Chromium increases your cell's sensitivity to insulin and is depleted by refined sugars, white flour, and lack of exercise. One study showed users lost 4 pounds over 10 weeks compared with no pounds in the control group. You should take it with magnesium, which reduces low-grade inflammation that can be associated with insulin resistance. A dose of 600 micrograms of chromium has been shown to be effective for those with type 2 diabetes, but for others, stick to the recommended dose of 200 micrograms. Just because a little is good doesn't mean that taking a whole lot more is better. Taking too much chromium can hurt your kidneys. Become sensitive. Here's a tantalizing observation. Cinnamon seems to have an insulin-like effect, enhancing the satiety center in your brain while also reducing blood sugar and cholesterol levels. Just half a teaspoon a day can have some effect. Sprinkle it in cereal or on toast or add it to a smoothie. Get in the zone. Studies show that meditation has a statistically significant reduction of risk factors for coronary disease, such as blood pressure and insulin resistance. Find a quiet room, take a few minutes, close your eyes, and focus on one healthy word or phrase, like or omega-3 fatty acids.
Metabolic motors, your body's hormonal fat burners. Bad genes aren't something that you wore in high school. They're what can make you have a propensity for heart disease, baldness, mental problems, and putting on weight. Though diet and physical activity play the lead roles in losing fat and maintaining a healthy weight, your genes are part of the supporting cast. It is possible to eat like a guppy, but grow bigger than a beluga. Simply, some people have a bad genetic response to a good diet. That is, they put on weight, while other people, the scoundrels, can have a good genetic response to a bad diet. How do we know there's a genetic component to obesity? For one, studies of twins raised apart from each other show it. Two people with the same genes raised in different lifestyles and on different diets show about 30% of the same propensities for gaining weight. But genes don't just dictate how you metabolize fat. That is, whether you come from a big bone family or one that could fit through the slats in air vents. Genes help dictate many things regarding why you put on fat, like cravings for certain foods or the way you cope when you're stressed. And family ties also govern whether or not the homemade sauce has butter or olive oil. Nevertheless, what we're trying to do is shrink the size of your blue genes by shrinking the effect of your genes. While you have genetic influences that steer you towards a particular body type and behaviors, those dispositions and unhealthy decisions can be neutralized and minimized by eating the right foods, rebooting your body, and in effect, changing which of your genes are turned on and which are turned off. That's right, your choices turn on or turn off specific genes you have. For example, the flavonoids, antioxidants, in grape skins turn off the gene that makes an inflammatory protein that ages your arteries. Now that we've discussed why you eat, how your food moves, and the effect of storing excess fat, you need to know how your body burns fat. In this section, we'll discuss the body's natural ways of doing so, ways determined by your genes. And in the next section, we'll discuss ways you can add horsepower to your natural fat-burning engines. Of course, the place to start is with your metabolism, your body's thermostat, the rate at which you burn off extra fat. Metabolism literally means change. Most of the 1 million calories you consume every year are burned without you ever thinking anything of it. It takes energy for you to breathe and sleep and for all of your organs to function. The energy you consume and store is used primarily to power your anatomic systems and structures. Only 15% to 30% of your calories are burned through intentional physical activity, such as exercise or walking or doing the Wumba Wumba on your anniversary. So while you may think that spinning class or Bikram yoga is the primary pathway to frying fat, physical activity is only a fraction of it. You burn most of your calories by keeping your heart pumping, your brain remembering your spouse's birthday, and your liver disposing of last night's vodka concoction. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't many outside influences that slow down and speed up your burn rate. Any movement speeds metabolism, including fidgeting, called non-exercise activity thermogenesis in scientific lingo, or NEAT for short. Every increase in body temperature of 1 degree increases your metabolic rate by 14%. Eating protein appears to do the same thing naturally, by the way. When you sleep, your metabolic rate decreases by 10%. When you starve yourself for more than 12 hours, your metabolic rate actually goes down by 40%. When you skip meals, your body senses a dietary disaster looming and quickly goes into storage mode rather than burning mode. That's the primary reason why deprivation diets don't work. Your body panics about going into a famine, so it slows metabolism into emergency storing mode rather than a steady state of burning. Breakfast eaters are on average thinner than those who skip breakfast because they keep their metabolism genes turned on. This means that calories are more likely to be burned off before they can be turned into fat. In our battle to reduce our waistlines, we have several fearsome adversaries. And some of the greatest foes we will meet on the battlefield are our hormones. Sure, we all know that raging hormones can make a teenage boy become sex-obsessed or give a menopausal woman hot flashes so bad that she feels as though she's in Death Valley in August. But you may not know that your hormones have a lot to do with whether or not you're going to look good in a Speedo. Is something secretly making you fat? Before you hit yourself over the head with a stick of salami for lacking the willpower to resist the aforementioned salami, or if you can't figure out why you eat less than all your friends but still gain weight, consider your hormones may be influencing your body more than you think. Glands, which make up your endocrine system and produce your hormones, are responsible for the genetic condition that could be influencing your metabolism and your weight. The primary metabolic glands are thyroid gland. Thyroid hormone influences how quickly or slowly you burn energy. Too much hormone forces the body to waste energy too quickly. In extreme cases, it actually causes your heart muscle to become hypermetabolic and weaken. But if you don't produce enough thyroid hormone, you develop a condition called hypothyroidism, in which your metabolic rate turtles way down. The best way to check levels of thyroid hormone? A simple blood test. You have elevated thyroid stimulating hormone, TSH, if it's above 5 international units per liter. This means your body is desperately trying to build up your body's circulating free thyroid hormone levels, but is failing. TSH is released from your pituitary gland and tells your thyroid hormone to produce two hormones that help control metabolism. Though decreased thyroid levels are rarely the sole cause of being overweight, abnormal levels may indicate that you should see your doctor or an endocrinologist about whether you need to supplement your thyroid function in the form of a thyroid pill to boost your metabolism. Symptoms of hyperthyroidism include anxiety, heart palpitations, sleeplessness, and fast-growing hair and nails. For hypothyroidism, you may be lethargic, gain weight, have a reduced appetite, or have brittle nails. Adrenal glands. Adrenal glands sit like a dunce cap on the kidneys, but they are controlled by corticotropin-releasing hormone, CRH, which is made by the hypothalamus. This valuable relationship enables the adrenals to be very responsive to the sensory input from the world around us, like a charging woolly mammoth. When chronically stressed, your adrenal glands produce cortisol, and cortisol inhibits CRH, unfortunately, because CRH will decrease your desire to eat. High cortisol levels reduce insulin sensitivity, so diabetes becomes more common and adversely influences fat and protein metabolism. The kidney responds to high cortisol levels by retaining salt and water so that blood pressure increases. At the same time, other hormones created by the adrenal gland, including testosterone and its derivative estrogen, increase. This can lead to obesity-linked diseases like uterine fibroids and breast cancer. To measure cortisol levels, you need a blood test or 24-hour urine collection. Above 100 milligrams in 24 hours generally indicates a high level of cortisol. The cutoff numbers vary depending on the lab. By the way, this is also the reason why people on steroidal medications, for asthma for instance, seem to gain weight. Cortisol is a form of steroid. Pancreas. A normally functioning pancreas secretes insulin, the substance that helps glucose travel from the blood into muscle to produce energy and fat for storage. Insulin actually works a lot like leptin. It has a mechanism that tells you to eat less. But when insulin resistance occurs in cells, it negates the appetite-controlling effect. Especially in early diabetes, you can naturally avoid high blood sugar with your food choices. But when you eat high sugar foods without adequate insulin secretion to overcome insulin resistance, that's type 2 diabetes, you have less feedback of being full and less appetite reduction than appropriate. So the vicious hunger cycle continues. Hormones in action. Now, your goal shouldn't be to burn all of your fat, though you may often consider it to be so. The average person has about 2,500 calories of carbohydrate reserves, stored mostly in liver and muscle, to use for all kinds of functions that need energy, especially immediate energy, like when you're trying to catch a bus or escape a charging rhino. An average person has about 112,000 calories stored in fat. That is, if you are at your ideal weight, you typically have about 14 pounds of fat. The message, your body fat isn't the enemy unless you're carrying more than you need. We need fat to function. It's an energy bank account that we can withdraw from. The trick, of course, is to make sure we don't let our banks open up branches in every single part of our bodies. In all, you have 9 known hormones that tell you to eat more and 14 that tell you to stop eating. Hormones, like your own anatomic sports agent, are on your side. They're looking out for your health. But that doesn't mean you can't have genetic glitches. Maybe your body doesn't make leptin correctly, or your body has too much cortisol, or you can't get leptin to your brain, or none of your satiety-related hormones work at all. Those problems no amount of willpower can overcome. Reprogramming your hormonal circuitry is your only solution. You can't beat biology, but you can make it work for you. One perfect example of hormonal influence comes in the form of the hormone adiponectin, which we talked about earlier. The more adiponectin you have, the lower your weight and body fat percentages. And it's directly related to omental fat, your gut fat. If you don't have omental fat, you'll have more adiponectin flying around. It helps your muscles turn fat into energy and suppress your appetite. Now get this. When you lose weight, more adiponectin is available to your body. It's one of your body's greatest reward mechanisms. The more weight you lose, the better your body is able to deal with inflammation we talked about because of the protective effects of adiponectin. It's one of the reasons why when you gain weight, you start increasing the irritation in your body. You produce less of this natural anti-inflammatory agent. The sex factor. We all know what testosterone and estrogen do for things like body hair, breast size, and the desire to spend Saturday night rampaging between the sheets like a pair of Greco-Roman wrestlers. But your sex hormones can influence more than just the activity that goes on below your waist. They can also influence what happens to your waist. Reproductive hormone friendly fire. One of the most common causes of obesity in women comes from a condition called polycystic ovary syndrome. In fact, PCOS is responsible for 10 to 20% of the weight problems among younger women and is often diagnosed by irregular periods and by physical appearance. Abdominal obesity, acne, thinning hair, and male-like hair growth, for example, on the face. In the end, sufferers lose their feminine appearance. What happens is this. Women with PCOS have stingy ovaries. They get an egg all primed and ready to go in its follicle, but they won't hit send and ship the egg out. The follicle, raring to go, keeps sending out its messenger estrogen. Now, estrogen works great when it gets paired up with or balanced by another ovarian messenger called progestin, which gets released from the egg sac called the corpus luteum after the follicle ships out its egg. In PCOS, some of that excess estrogen running around gets converted to androgens or male hormones. These cause that extra hair growth and increased appetite. That's when the pounds add on. To combat this drive for another slice of coconut cream meringue, many women go on the birth control pill, which stops the weight gain by giving finite doses of estrogen and progestin, telling the ovaries to quiet down. The pill alone won't cause you to lose or gain, but having less of a voracious appetite and reversing the hormonal burden of PCOS often will. Testosterone. It may be what produces chin hair and male egos, but testosterone is also found in women and is another hormone that could play a role in weight gain in both genders. Testosterone levels tend to fall in postmenopausal women and older men. This reduces libido and can lead to weight gain because you have less muscle mass and more calories get stored as fat. When the cause of weight gain isn't clear through other diagnoses and the cause of libido loss isn't clear, supplementation with testosterone patches or topical testosterone gels or creams could make sense, not only to reverse a plummeting libido, but maybe, just maybe, to eliminate a paunch. And some argue that increased sexual satisfaction can help with satiety. Quick note, testosterone is currently under investigation and not ready for primetime use. So before you consider treatment, know that testosterone has risk factors and several side effects, including acne, facial hair growth, and rage reactions. U-tips. If you think it's not you, find the cause. For some of you, it doesn't matter whether you eat like a worm or exercise like a thoroughbred. You just can't lose weight. Hormones are an appropriate scapegoat for some with knee-tickling guts. If you're convinced that your fat can't be attributed to your lifestyle, it's worth asking your doctor about blood tests that measure hormone and other chemical levels to see what medications may address hormonal issues. Do a once-over. PCOS can be diagnosed with a blood test that measures total free testosterone. If your ratio of luteinizing hormone to follicle-stimulating hormone is greater than 3:1, that can also indicate PCOS. Treatment comes in the form of birth control pills to regulate the hormonal patterns and the diabetes drug metformin or glucophage to help prevent a crossfire that happens between the ovary and the pancreas and to calm the inflammatory responses in the liver so that it helps the body become more sensitive to insulin. Make the move, how you can burn fat faster. We all know that muscles give us the power to lift boxes and babies. They give us the power to walk around the mall and sprint for the 5:32 train to Schenectady. And depending on your taste in movie star muscle, they have the power to make your tongue wag faster than a golden retriever's tail. But you don't have to be an appliance delivery man, an Olympic shot putter, or an oiled-up spring breaker to benefit from muscle. When it comes to waste management, the real power of muscles lies in their ability to work like an anatomical pack of wolves. While your hormones are responsible for a large portion of your metabolism, your muscles can expedite the process of burning extra calories. While muscles give us the metabolic ability to burn calories every time we move, during exercise, during gardening, during sex, their true advantage is that they constantly feed on calories, even when you're moving about as fast as a skateboard with a busted wheel. See, every pound of muscle burns between 40 and 120 calories a day just to sustain itself, while every pound of fat feeds on only 1 to 3 calories. Day after day, that's a huge difference in your metabolic rate and your daily calorie burn. When you add a water bottle full of muscle to your body, you're able to burn a refrigerator full of fat. When we think about muscles, we tend to think about the really big ones, Hulk Hogan's, or the really nice ones, Brad Pitt's abs, Hilary Swank's shoulders. Working your muscles isn't necessarily about making you big, brawny, and eligible for the NFL draft. By focusing on the right muscles and following the right plan, you won't add bulk. You'll firm up, and you'll stimulate the amount of growth needed to help burn extra calories. Best of all, you don't need any expensive equipment or a gym membership to see the benefits of adding muscle. You need only one piece of equipment, your own body. Your body is your gym. Your muscles, strength builders and fat burners. Your skeletal muscles, that is the muscles attached to your bones by tendons and ligaments, not the involuntary ones associated with working your organs like your heart or esophagus, come in pairs. That allows one muscle to move a bone in one direction while the other moves it in another. When you bend your arm at the elbow, your bicep muscle pulls your upper and lower arm together, while your tricep muscle pushes them away from each other. Now, we could bore you to a pond's worth of tears by explaining the biology of muscle, so we'll summarize what you need to know. Skeletal muscle is designed to do two kinds of things, to make you fast and to make you strong. It's made up of bundles of fibers, each of which is like a strand of spaghetti. These fibers have filaments that have to slide over each other like an expandable ladder. When your brain sends the message for your muscles to move, to walk, to lift a couch, to kiss your lover's ear, your muscles contract the way an extendable ladder would contract, by ratcheting the poles up and down. And it uses a catcher hook to stop the muscle and keep it opened or closed. Now you can build up two parts of that ladder, the actual poles, which give you strength, and the force it takes to move those poles up and down, which gives you stamina. The force-generating structures act like calorie-guzzling cyclers, pedaling furiously to pull together muscle fibers. Elastic recoil, generated by the contraction and aided by stretching, helps the muscles relax after exercise. The two main forms of exercise, stamina training and strength training, influence the structures of the ladder differently. Stamina training increases your muscles' capacity to produce and use the energy they need to contract, since you are adding more powerful cyclers. But muscle strength requires strength training that builds up the ladder poles, making for a bigger, stronger, and sturdier muscle fiber structure. How? When you do any kind of resistance training, you create tiny tears in your muscle fibers. Your body reacts to those tears by saying, "If you can tear down my ladder, I'm going to build a stronger, bigger one next time." And your body builds back bigger and stronger ladder poles. Walking, by the way, increases both your energy capacity and your poles, which is one of the many reasons why it's a central part of this plan. By regularly doing strength training, you create more muscle mass that you need to help you burn fat. In essence, you make the spaghetti strands a little thicker and stronger rather than making more spaghetti strands. Muscle serves as a primary energy consumer for your body. Think of it as a raging fire. Toss a log into it, and it'll burn the log up pretty quickly. But your fat is more like one lit match. It would take years for that match to burn the log. In your body, muscle can fry up that cheese dog a lot faster than can fat, thus reducing the amount of fat you store. Add just a little more muscle, and you'll use more energy and store less fat. And that makes strength training an even more efficient exercise for burning fat than cardiovascular training. That's pretty crucial when you consider that we lose an average of 5% of our muscle mass every 10 years after the age of 35, if we don't do anything about it. Historically, hunters, gatherers, and carriers of children needed their muscle strength until they were about 35, when the kids were able to walk and younger tribesmen could hunt. But after they turned 35, their bodies didn't give two tubers about whether they had any muscle, so their bodies adapted and allowed for that gradual loss. Today, we see drastic effects when we lose muscle. We gain weight. If you don't intentionally rebuild muscle through exercise, every 10 years, you'll need to eat 120 to 420 fewer calories each day to maintain your current weight. So if you're at a stable weight at age 35 and don't do any kind of resistance training, while still eating the same amount of food, you'll gain weight. Now, as your muscle ages, you'll also lose a little bit of the proteins that make up your muscle. They're what give your muscle the ability to have both strength and stamina. Exercise rebuilds and maintains proteins and muscle mass to prevent you from gaining weight. Here's what you need to do. 1. 30 minutes of walking a day to help rebuild the stamina and strength-based proteins. That prepares your muscles for 2. 30 minutes of strength or resistance training a week to rebuild strength-based proteins. That's once a week for 30 minutes, or split up in 2 15-minute sessions or 3 10-minute ones. Later, we'll outline the specifics of the plan, but we also want to explain that muscle is the heavyweight prize fighter, not just in its ability to clobber fat, but also because it's literally heavy. When people start to exercise and eat healthier, their initial reaction is typically frustration because it seems like their weight doesn't change that much at first. That's because fat floats and muscle sinks. Muscle is simply a lot heavier than fat. So as you build a little bit of muscle mass and lose fat, you may not see a dramatic reduction in scale numbers right away, but you will see reductions in waist size and overall shape. After you make it through the initial transition into exercise, chances are that you'll continue to see more dramatic changes in your body composition, your metabolism, your weight, and your waist. Now the question is, how do we add more muscle rather than just maintaining what we've got? And how do we do it without ending up looking like a middle linebacker for the Bears? The answer, of course, lies in exercise, but perhaps not in the way you might think. Most of us break down exercise into two categories: stamina-based training, aerobic, like jogging or swimming, and strength-based training, like lifting weights. Any kind of exercise burns calories while you're doing the activity, but the most potent and long-lasting fat burners are created not when you're swimming or running, as you might believe, but after strength training. That makes muscle one of your body's greatest anatomic allies. Here, we're going to show you how to take advantage of your muscle's muscle, the right way, the easy way, the way that will not only get you more stairs than a Monet masterpiece, but also help you get the waist you want. While many diet plans don't discuss the role of exercise, we consider physical activity vital to inflate your health and deflate your waist size. Building muscle is one component, but cardiovascular training and increasing your flexibility are also part of your waist management plan. Together, the three components of exercise will have numerous effects on your body. First, exercise increases your metabolism so that you burn energy at a higher rate than if you didn't exercise, and it reduces your appetite by turning on your sympathetic nervous system, which activates your fight or flight response. Do the experiment yourself. Take a quick walk or jog when you feel the first twinge of hunger. Presto, your hunger is gone when you return. Second, exercise will help you lose the extra weight that's stressing your joints. By dropping weight, you'll feel less pain in your knees, hips, ankles, and back. And that will put you into a positive cycle of behavior so that you'll have the desire to exercise more. Third, exercise stimulates the release of endorphins, which stimulate the pleasure centers of the brain. When they're stimulated, they give you a sense of control, which is associated with a decreased need to eat out of control. Fourth, exercise helps decrease depression and increases positive attitude so that you'll make other positive choices and don't have to use food as your medication. That will also help prevent your couch, chair, and bed from becoming anti-waste management devices. Fifth, exercise keeps your blood vessels open and clog-free, thus decreasing your risk of obesity-related morbidities like high blood pressure, elevated lousy cholesterol, memory problems, and heart attacks. We could spend dozens of pages listing all the benefits of physical activity, but we think you get the point. You don't have to be an infomercial beefcake with a shaved chest to make physical activity a priority, and you don't have to spend 3 hours a day doing it to see the benefits. In fact, what's so wonderful about exercise is that unlike the things you have to take away from your life, junk food, excuses, physical activity is something you can add, all while watching Raymond reruns. When you get your muscles moving in the right direction, your waist size will follow. When you first start exercising, your body will respond with very outward signs. You'll sweat. You may feel sore. You may stink like a month-old macaroni salad. Your body will start responding on the inside with changes in muscle size, blood flow, and blood chemistry. While exercise, even combined with a healthy diet, won't suck fat out of you instantaneously, you will see and feel changes in your body shape, even within a week. And with the combined you workout and eating plan, you may see a 2-inch reduction in waist size within the first 2 weeks as your body composition changes. So get up and get moving. U-tips. Know your Fantastic Four. Physical activity and exercise are like vegetables. They come in all shapes, sizes, and tastes, and just about all of them are good for you. Depending on your health level and experience, you need to be thinking about including these components of activity in your life. First, walking. We do it at the mall, around the house, and back and forth from the fridge to the waterbed. And yes, any walking is healthy. The optimal is to hit at least 10,000 steps a day, but you also need to dedicate a total of 30 minutes a day to walking. It's the foundation for all other exercise because it not only increases your stamina, but prepares your body for strength training. As a daily routine, walking is the psychological discipline that helps you stick with an activity plan. In fact, it has the highest compliance rate of any exercise. Commit to walking, and you'll start committing to more than just the TV lineup on Thursday nights. Second, strength. Even if the only barbell you've ever seen is the one that's piercing your buddy's tongue, that doesn't mean you should shy away from resistance training. Strength training, whether you use dumbbells, machines, bands, or your own body weight, helps rebuild muscle fibers and increase muscle mass, which will use up all those extra calories that you crave, so that you can burn calories more efficiently and help prevent age-related weight gain. Now here's the key to making it work. Many Americans tend to spend a lot of time working their peripheral muscles, like their biceps or their calves. But efficient strength training comes when you work the big muscles that make up the core axis of your body, your legs, the large muscles of your upper body, like your chest, shoulders, and back, and your abdominals. They're your foundation muscles. Best of all, you don't need a single piece of equipment to see the benefits. One quick note about abdominal exercises. They won't burn fat per se, but they will strengthen your entire core to help flatten and tone your stomach when you do burn fat. And they'll give you a layer of muscle support that will also protect your lower back from injury. The tighter your abs, the less excess strain you'll cause your lower back. You can't build a house from the second floor down. And in a way, your abdominal muscles and your entire core provide a base foundation that you can build upon. Third, cardiovascular stamina. By doing cardiovascular exercise, that is any activity that raises your heart rate for a sustained period of time, you'll increase your overall stamina, burn calories, and improve the function and efficiency of your heart, as well as lower your blood pressure. Getting your body to sweat also helps you to release toxins that would otherwise build up in your tissues. Fourth, flexibility. Being flexible isn't just a good trait for yoga teachers and potential spouses. It's also what you want for your muscles. Good flexibility helps prevent injuries to your joints because stretching works your muscles through a wide range of motion that you'll go through during exercise and everyday activity. Plus, being flexible just makes you feel better. It keeps your body from feeling stiffer than a week-old roach corpse. Helps facilitate meditation, and allows you to center yourself as you focus on your body. Plus, the more pliable and loose you are, the less you're affected when you fall or get into accidents. Excuse-proof your life. When it comes to working out, most of us have two excuse cards we like to play. We have the ace of no time and the jack of it's not convenient. Now, we know you're busy. We know you're juggling more balls than a 12-armed clown. We know it's easier to sit on the couch than do a push-up on the floor. But we also know this. Time and convenience aren't excuses. First of all, with the U plan, you don't need a whole lot of time. If you don't have the time to do this, then you'll have to admit that the problem is not that you're out of time, but that your life is so out of control that you can't budget enough time for your health and your well-being. And secondly, you don't need a gym or fancy equipment. Heck, it takes more time to drive to the gym and change clothes than it does to actually work out. You can do all of this activity at home with a few modest pieces of equipment or even by making use of items you already have. In fact, in the U workout plan, you'll use your body as your weights. It sure beats spending your workout time waiting at the exercise machine for someone to finish her issue of quilting quarterly. Yes, it's easy to say you're too tired, too stressed, too busy, too this or too that. We say too bad. The only way you'll strip away the fat is to start by stripping away the excuses. You move, you lose. One unsung form of exercise, fidgeting. Studies show that fidgety people are simply skinnier people. If you have two people working the same job and eating the same diet, the one who gets up to talk to someone down the hall rather than emailing her will be skinnier. Studies show that it isn't some mysterious food, organ cell, or gremlin that makes these people burn up fat like an iron skillet. It's these fidgeting movements. Now, that's not to say that if you go on an all-fidgeting, leg-shaking, finger-tapping program, you'll be thinner than a Hilton sister. But numerous studies have shown that the more you move, in very subtle ways, the more calories your body will burn throughout the day. Find an excuse to move your muscles wherever you are. Clear the dishes. Stand up and walk in circles while you're on the phone. Walk down the hall and ask a coworker questions rather than IMing her. Tap your toes in a meeting. Take every opportunity to move around, and you'll give your body subtle metabolism boosters that may just have more than subtle effects. You test. How fit are you? There are lots of ways to gauge progress on a weight loss plan. Inches lost, Wendy's coupons tossed. But you can also measure your fitness levels in different areas of activity. Use these tests to see how you stack up. Before doing each test, make sure to properly warm up by walking or doing light exercise for at least 5 minutes. First, cardiovascular. You can measure your heart's efficiency by measuring your heart rate after exercise. After exercising for a period of 18 minutes at 80 to 85% of your max, that's 220 minus your age, do 3 minutes at your maximum heart rate. Then stop and check your pulse. Your heart rate should decrease 66 beats or more after 2 minutes of stopping. Do not do this without approval of your doctor unless you do it regularly as part of your normal workout. Second, muscular. To gauge upper body muscular stamina, do the push-up test. Women can do it with knees on the floor. A 30-year-old man should be able to do at least 35, five less every decade after that, until he reaches 70. A 30-year-old woman should be able to do 45 with knees on the floor, five less every decade until she reaches 80. Third, flexibility. Measure lower back flexibility by sitting on the floor with your legs straight out in front of you and slightly spread apart, with one hand on top of the other and fingertips lined up. Lean forward and reach for your feet. Women 45 and under should be able to reach 2 to 4 inches past their feet. Older women should be able to reach their soles. Men aged 45 and under should be able to reach their soles. Older men should be able to come within 3 to 4 inches of their soles. Fourth, squeeze yourself. Here's an abdominal exercise you can do anywhere. Suck your belly button in tight and squeeze your butt in as if you're trying to pull up a pair of too tight jeans. Pretend the top of your head is being pulled by a string to the ceiling. Now hold that position. Besides putting you into proper posture, it's working your transverse abdominis muscle, your supportive girdle muscle. Do it on the elevator, waiting in line, at work, and anywhere you walk.
The chemistry of emotions, the connections between feelings and food. Our ancestors ate to survive. They ate because they were hungry, or maybe to celebrate a victory over a warring tribe. Us, we eat because we're angry, bored, stressed, depressed, frustrated, watching a movie, busy, not busy enough, getting together with friends, or PO'd that the lion's lost. What we think of as an emotional reaction, where we substitute chocolate for a conversation, or ice cream for a bath, or chips for a punching bag, isn't always as much about character as it is about chemistry. Earlier you learned about the chemical reactions that take place in your body that stimulate hunger. Leptin and ghrelin are the joysticks that control our eating actions. But oftentimes, the physical action of eating can be triggered by emotions that coax us to wolf down that mustard-smothered dog. We'll discuss how the science of your brain and emotions can contribute to what and why you eat. While emotions are the least understood part of the obesity issue, they're also a very real part of overeating for many people. Your hypothalamus is also the part of your brain where your mind and body literally connect. As the bosom buddy of the hypothalamus, the pituitary gland sends chemicals to talk to the rest of the body. It's really where the whole weight loss game is won and lost. This connection between physiological and psychological needs for eating. As you well know, emotional eating isn't about reaching for celery. Rather, it's an out-of-control, hedonistic eating where we eat every cookie in the bag because they look good and taste even better. It's a craving, and usually for something that's starchy, sugary, salty, or loaded with fat. The following five brain chemicals are the ones that primarily influence our emotions. And not only do they provide the foundation for why we eat at certain times, but they're also the key chemicals in many of our current and future weight loss drugs. Please know that we're purposely leaving out the intricate web of interactions that take place among these chemicals and the non-emotional effects. The intricacies of these interactions, fully understood by only a few people in the world, are real but not integral to your understanding of the science of the emotions for eating. To deal with some of the emotions and stresses that lead to eating, you have to remember that the brain chemicals that influence our hunger and our moods are our why regulators of eating. Norepinephrine, the caveman fight-or-flight chemical, is what tells you to tangle with the saber-toothed tiger or hightail it to the safety of your hut. Serotonin, it's the James Brown of neurotransmitters. It makes you feel good and is a major target of antidepressant drugs. Dopamine, the brain's funhouse. It's a pleasure and reward system and is particularly sensitive to addictions. It's also the one that helps you feel no pain. GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid, the English patient of amino acids. It makes you feel like a zombie and is one of the ways that anesthesia may work to reduce your responsiveness to the outside world. Nitric oxide, the meditation-like chemical. It helps calm you. This powerful neuropeptide is usually a very short-lived gas that also relaxes the blood vessels of the body. Now, the real question is, what do all these chemicals have to do with whether or not you snack on a Hershey's bar or a plum? Probably the best way to think about it is to use serotonin as an example. Picture your brain as a small pinball machine. You have millions of neurotransmitters that are sending messages to and from one another. When your serotonin transmitters fire the signals from the flippers, they send the message throughout your brain that you feel good. This message is strongest when that feel-good pinball is frenetically bouncing around in your brain, racking up tons of yeah baby points along the way. But when you lose the ball down the chute, that is when the cells in the brain take serotonin and break it down. That love the world feeling you've been experiencing is lost. So what does your brain want to do? Put another quarter in the machine and get another ball. For many of us, the next ball comes in the form of foods that naturally and quickly make us feel good, to counteract the drop in serotonin that we're feeling. Unfortunately, the way we typically satisfy our urge to play another ball is to use the foods that provide an immediate rush of serotonin. That rush comes with a jolt of sugar. Sugar stimulates the release of insulin. Insulin stimulates serotonin uptake into the brain, which in turn boosts our mood, makes us feel better, or masks the stress, pain, boredom, anger, or frustration that we may be feeling. But serotonin is only one ball in play. You have all of these other chemicals fighting to send your appetite and cravings from bumper to bumper. To see how the total picture works, think of these chemicals as part of a scale. When the chemicals associated with positive feelings, like serotonin or dopamine, are in the up or activated position, you're chemically high. When they're down, you experience a big chemical downfall. And this puts you in a state of anxiety that sends you searching for more foods, especially those simple carbohydrates that can get you back into the chemical high. That's how illegal drugs work too. Users keep seeking the high, not always for its own sake, but to avoid the lows. You're constantly fighting to get back to that place of neurochemical comfort. When these chemicals are high, your weight gets lower. And when they're lower, you reach for the foods that eventually make your weight higher. That's the reason why what happens under your skull plays such a vital role in what happens under your belt. Knowing how your emotions can steer your desire to eat will help you to resist your cravings and, ideally, avoid them altogether. Your goal? Keep your feel-good hormones level so that you're in a steady state of satisfaction and never experience huge hormonal highs and lows that make you search for a good-for-your-brain but bad-for-your-waist food. We'll explore this further with the deeper emotions that can contribute to eating, hunger, and weight gain. U-tips. Work foods in your favor. Foods all have different effects on your stomach, your blood, and your brain. These are some of the nutrients that may influence your hunger and the brain chemicals that affect it. Turkey contains tryptophan, which increases serotonin to improve your mood and combat depression, and help you resist cravings for simple carbohydrates. Omega-3 fatty acids, which are found in fish, have long been known as brain boosters and cholesterol clears, but they've also been shown convincingly to help with depression in pregnant women. Depression contributes to hedonistic and emotional eating. Since many of us have low omega-3 intake, it might explain some other instances of depression as well. Savor the sinful foods. If you're going to eat something that's bad for you, enjoy it, savor it, roll it around in your mouth. We suggest taking a piece of dark 70% cocoa chocolate and meditating as a healthy stress reliever and as a way to reward yourself with something sweet. We're trying to find small ways to make you feel good and increase serotonin so you don't plummet and scavenge for anything you can find. It's okay to eat bad foods every once in a while. Go to sleep. Getting enough sleep keeps you thin. That's because when your body doesn't get the 7 to 8 hours of sleep it needs every night to get rejuvenated, it needs to find ways to compensate for neurons not secreting the normal amounts of serotonin and dopamine. The way it typically does that is by craving sugary foods that will give you an immediate release of serotonin and dopamine. The lack of sleep throws off your entire system, even increasing your levels of MPY, which increase your appetite. Lack of sleep can become an even bigger factor as you age. When you get older, the pineal gland in your brain produces less of the sleep hormone melatonin, resulting in a craving for carbohydrates. Shame on who? The psychology of the failed diet. Most diets aren't about action, they're about thoughts. By their very nature, they force us to think. Diets make us think about food more than inmates think about escape. You have to think about calories, or zones, or the hour when you're next allowed to have half a cracker. You think about not having food so much that you develop only two sets of standards when it comes to eating. Either you follow your diet, or you don't. It's bean sprouts, or it's prime rib. It's carrots, or it's cookies. It's cucumbers, or it's pepperoni. It's all, or it's nothing. In a way, we've all been thinking too much about weight and what to eat, and not enough about how and why we eat. When most of us try to lose weight, we pull out the most powerful weapon we like to think we know, our brains, and launch a psychological attack in the form of discipline. I can resist this food. And ego. I'm smart enough to avoid this food. But the truth is, there are very strong emotional triggers that make us eat, and make most diets fail. In many ways, it's our brains that sabotage our best dieting efforts. By trying the very thing that's designed to help us lose weight, a diet, we've created a no-win system of failure that spins us into a cycle of blame. And what's not to blame? The experts blame our societal fatness on free restaurant bread and meals with Mount McKinley-sized portions. Or we blame our fatness on fast food, magazine covers, 60-hour work weeks, cloud-soft recliners and reality TV, sausage, or an intervention-worthy Velveeta addiction. But deep down in your gut, there's really only one thing you blame for the size of your gut. You. You blame you. You tell yourself it's not the restaurant or the food manufacturers or deep-fried cheap stuffed peppers that are derailing your weight loss efforts. It's your mind. The entire battle of the broken belt comes down to a flurry of mental if-onlys. And your perceived inability to control what food you shuttle down your esophagus year after year, day after day, meal after meal, and bite after bite. If only you had the willpower to step away from the mayonnaise. If only you could stop after 4 Pringles. If only you had the power, the strength, the discipline, the chutzpah, the energy, the drive, the motivation to control your waist. Then you'd finally have the body you want. What you're really doing here is laying brain blame. We rely on our minds to resist temptations, to make smart decisions, to eat right, to know better, and to make healthy choices. So we naturally rely on our minds to combat the emotions that we think we should be able to handle. Stress, anxiety, depression. So when we give up on a diet and balloon to a size that makes doorways cringe, then we automatically think something's wrong with us, that our minds aren't strong enough to win over our waists. The reason we fail? Researchers theorize that it's your mind that might be crossed up, but not because of anything you're doing. At least scientifically, overeating may work a little bit like a drug addiction. In fact, studies show that obese people even have reward centers in the brain similar to those of drug addicts. So let's say you're stressed. Remember the hypothalamus and the chemicals that change according to your moods? At points of stress, you've activated neurotransmitters from a part of the brain called the locus coeruleus. Your body, in response, tries to calm those neurotransmitters and combat the stress. Some people do it with cigarettes. Some do it with food. Some do it with sex, and some do it with drugs. When you combat the stress with food, you're also activating the reward center of your brain. And then, after that initial feel-good system wears off, you'll reach again for the same thing that made you feel good, calm, and relaxed. Food. That's why stress and anxiety make it that much more difficult, neurochemically, to stick to whatever plan you're trying to follow. What's especially interesting is that right next to the hypothalamus, where the feeding and satiety chemicals MPY and CART are produced, is a part of the brain called the mammillary body, because it physically looks like a pair of breasts. That's where food memory is stored. So when you get the signal that you're hungry, you're also accessing your memory of and cravings for foods you've eaten in the past, which may have been bad foods. Plus, the parietal region of the brain, the control center of the movement of the tongue, lips, and mouth, act differently in heavy people than skinny people. Brain scans show that in heavy people tempted with sugar, this region becomes activated. In skinny people, the region stays dormant, showing how sugar can play a role in emotional eating for some people, but not for others. If you're struggling with waist issues, you've probably placed all the responsibility for dietary success or failure on your little 3-pound brain. You've expected it to go head-to-head with such formidable foes as deep-fried taco shells and Alfredo sauce. But you can't outwit nature. There are simply too many of those hormones and neurotransmitters whose jobs roughly translate to pass the pound cake. And to expect that your will or fortitude can override these chemical messages is the equivalent of trying to stop a train with your pinky. Dieting, avoiding the issue. For a second, think about one particular kind of person, the extreme example of fat gone wild. These people are often the stereotypical ideal: funny, kind, generous, charming, articulate, creative, and more brilliant than a perfect diamond, except for the fact that they are regularly mistaken for a 4-story silo. We all say it, he's so great, if only he were thin. And that bothers us. It bothers us because we can't figure out the yin and yang of the situation. How can a person smart enough to know the difference between scrapple and apples, or driven enough to have a successful career, be the very same person who, night after night, gets clobbered silly by a helpless sleeve of Oreos hiding in the back of the pantry shelf? Something has to be wrong. And it is. But it's about as likely to be what you think as you are to find your true love in Las Vegas. The issues aren't at waistband level, they're at brain level. You may know that you have health problems and a waist circumference the size of Neptune. And you may even know that you struggle with the emotional issues of confidence and esteem that come as a side orders with the entree of obesity. But you may not know that you could be what's called an avoider, and that you suffer internally from a tornado of psychological turmoil that comes with the public and private disdain for obesity, and you avoid confronting your situation at all because of the internal fear of not being able to beat it. Here's how avoiders think. Not if this sounds familiar. Once you deviate, even slightly, from a diet or healthy eating plan, you figure you might as well drop the whole thing. Are you nodding? And this starts a cycle that avoiders can't find a way out of. We're fat, we try to lose weight. We deviate just a little. We fear rejection for the perceived failure. We isolate ourselves from people. We stop talking about it. We stop the diet. We mow through a pound of cheesecake, we get fat. And then we try to lose weight, and the cycle continues. Avoiders at all levels will see their weight bop up and down like a bull rider. Physiologically, it's a never-ending cycle of weight gain and loss. That's called weight cycling. But the real avoider issues stem from the psychological effects of weight cycling. Instead of avoiding bad foods, avoiders tend to want to avoid other things, like the people who want to help them, and the discipline of trying to eat healthfully. Above all, avoiders try to separate themselves from these two strong emotions associated with dieting. Guilt. I hope they don't find out. No matter what kind of diet you may have tried in the past, you've undoubtedly worked with a list of off-limits foods. High-protein diets might ban potatoes. Low-fat diets might ban cheese. Sugar-busting diets may ban you from ever setting foot in Aunt Thelma's kitchen again. Inevitably, like a child instructed not to touch the champagne flutes, you will want potatoes, you will want cheese, and you will find it incredibly rude to turn down Aunt Thelma's snickerdoodles 3 times in a row. So you cave. But because you've set yourself up with a list of banned foods, you perceive half a cookie, or a hunk of Gouda, or 3 measly fries as first-degree diet homicide. The diet's dead.